This episode is brought to you by Rotman Executive Programs. Here in Canada, we spell AI with an E-H. Get it? A? No, I'm not going to. Okay. This episode is brought to you by Rotman Executive Programs. Canada is where a lot of AI was pioneered, and if you want to know how to get AI to work for you in your business and your organization, check out Rotman's Generative AI and Organizational Transformation Program. Future-proof your organization with Rotman. Visit www.uft.me/rotmanai to learn more. Don't forget the W's. www.uft.me/rotmanai to learn more. This episode is also brought to you by Douglas. Kurt Cobain once asked, but wasn't it Leadbelly? That was a Leadbelly cover. This episode is also brought to you by Douglas. Kurt Cobain covering Leadbelly once asked, "Tell me, my girl, where did you sleep last night?" For over 200,000 Canadians, the answer would have been simple: on their Douglas. What, too soon? Come on. Join them and discover sleep nirvana with the affordable comfort of a Douglas mattress. Douglas is giving our listeners a free sleep bundle with each mattress purchase. Get the sheets, pillows, mattress, and pillow protectors free with your Douglas purchase today. Visit douglas.ca/canadaland to claim this offer. That's douglas.ca/canadaland. Senior fellow and scholar in residence at the Center for Free Expression, professor emeritus at Toronto Metropolitan University, and author of The Disputed Freedoms of a Disrupted Press, Ivor Shapiro.
Jesse Brown.
Good to have you here, Ivor. Today on the show, Elon makes lemonade, Justin gets Orwellian. We will take a second look at Canada's new speech laws. And bring us your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free. We'll put them somewhere, I guess. The evolving conversation about immigration in Canada. Welcome to Shortcuts, where we talk shit about the news. This episode is brought to everybody by Rachel Gurney, Tony Stark, Sean Van Wyck, Christina Phillip, Brian Manning, Ruben Sweet, Shiloh Fayad, and Josh.
Hi, I'm Josh, a music teacher in Calgary. I support Canada Land because they cover the stories that the big media outlets don't or won't. Like many of you, I really enjoy the work being done by the team at Commons and can't wait for the new season. The perspectives on Canada Land and Shortcuts often give me something new to consider. But remember, Jesse, not all conservatives are the devil.
So, Don, you love censorship, is what you're saying.
No, I don't love censorship.
Yes, you want censorship and I don't.
No, I don't want censorship at
all. Yes, you do.
No, I want responsibility.
You desperately want censorship.
No, if I want a censorship.
You want censorship so bad you can taste it.
No, that's not true.
So that high-level debate, Ivor, was Elon Musk, who bought Twitter and then banned journalists that he does not like from it, demonstrating his passion for free speech. In a train wreck of an interview with Don Lemon, it was the first episode of Don Lemon's new show on the Twitter X platform, and his last because Elon Musk promptly fired him after that interview did not go his way. Elon Musk absurdly has been presenting himself as an outspoken champion for free speech as global calls for increased regulation on hate speech and other forms of harmful speech have gotten louder and louder, and as new laws have been introduced around the world, Musk called Canada's new Online Harms Act insane, with specific reference to the fact that hate speech under our new proposed laws will carry a maximum sentence of life in prison, which I gotta say, like, fair enough, that is pretty wild. And that was what we talked about when we first talked about the Online Harms Act on this show. Ivor, what I want to talk with you about today is how the conversation about this bill and the coverage of this bill is evolving, because it's sort of migrated from news stories trying to get their heads a very large piece of legislation that covers a lot of ground. And the early stories in our early conversation about it was like looking at things like that life sentence, which was like that stuck out like a red flag. But as it's gone from these factual accounts in news reports to opinion columns about it, and then reaction tweets to those opinion columns by famous Canadian novelists, the conversation has changed and it's really lasered in. It's focused and gotten a bit weird on one aspect that actually escaped my attention of the online harms bill. Have you been following this?
Somewhat, yes.
I know that these issues, free speech issues and free press issues, are very important to you. I'm gonna take our listeners through some of the coverage here. Here's Bill C-63, the Online Harms Act, as it spread through the world, actually, because this has attracted global attention. In The Spectator UK, Trudeau's Orwellian Online Harms Bill. The Epoch Times, Online Harms Act, the latest manifestation of Canada's new maternal fascism. The Times of India, no free speech, new Orwellian law endorsed by Trudeau government could imprison people for life. Fox News, Canadians were warned about doubling down on the push to restrict free speech, not likely to end there. The Telegraph UK, Canada's descent into tyranny is almost complete. It's not just, you know, often these things get reduced when they're covered internationally, but Canadian coverage has also focused on this idea. Andrew Coyne in the Globe and Mail calls the bill staggeringly reckless. What all of these voices are focusing in on is, again, a piece that I did not even notice at first, this idea that this bill punishes future crimes. What this means is that hate speech that you are likely to make but have not yet made could result in you going to jail. And when I first read that, I thought, I think they got this wrong. Like, that was not my understanding of it. So I thought that maybe this was like inflammatory rhetoric. And then it moves from like partisan criticism to people like Margaret Atwood, arguably Canada's greatest living novelist, echoing fears that we're moving towards some sort of a tyrannical dystopia. You know, when Margaret Atwood raises those fears, I pay attention. What is this based on? Where are they getting this from?
So, as you said, it's a huge piece of legislation, 105 pages. My printer last night, because my lawyer friends always print things out, my printer last night actually ran out of ink trying to print this thing. What it's trying to do effectively is three things at once. It's not just an online harms legislation, which really focuses hard in on protecting children, making platforms have a duty to take revenge porn offline, stuff like that, literally online harm content. Then there is a whole piece of it that amends the criminal code provisions on hate speech, which you're kind of talking about a bit. And then sometimes in the commentary, completely mixed up in it, are provisions which make it possible, again, as it once was, to take hate speech as an act of discrimination to the Human Rights Commission and say, I'm being discriminated against because I am a member of a marginalized group. I'm being discriminated against by these speech. Actually, three completely different pieces of legislation. And then pages and pages of stuff that I don't understand. I'm not a lawyer. Legislation is written by lawyers, for lawyers, for lawyers to argue, for lawyers to adjudicate. It's a big chunk of stuff to get your head around. And I think in some of the commentaries, there's quite a bit of confusion between one part and another, between the human rights stuff and the criminal stuff. And there's been some pretty good and thoughtful commentary out there. And then there's been some nonsense. Unfortunately, the Margaret Atwood tweet that you referred to, is it still called tweets or are they called X's now or something?
I've got to call them tweets.
Okay, we got to call them tweets. So Margaret Atwood's tweet was literally, I think she said something like, if she was referring to a Spectator column.
Huge if true.
If this column, which was a pretty out there column, which made a lot of allegations, which I think were big stretches.
I'll read from it.
Please, please.
If this account of the bill is true, it's lettres de cachet all over again, which I'll admit is a reference that's lost on me. The possibilities for revenge, false accusations, and thought crime stuff are so inviting. Trudeau's Orwellian online harms bill.
Right. She's referring to Louis XIV's. This is a king of France before the invention of democracy. Louis XIV's right to imprison people because he said so. Basically.
Mm-hmm. Crime and punishment, but the punishment before the crime, as the Wall Street Journal put it when writing about this.
We're right back there, right? So it's all a bit excessive. And I think people who try to help people understand what's going on in society, which is actually what journalism is supposed to do, both the news reporting and the commentary, that's what journalism's for, have some kind of duty to kind of glance at the structure of the bill, at least, even if they don't want to read it. And I don't blame them if they don't want to read it. I mean, Margaret Atwood's tweet seems to have really had an impact, as you said, even on you. And it's all based on basically surmise.
Is it, though? Because I figure that usually there's some kernel that they're extrapolating from, maybe in bad faith, and maybe other people in good faith are believing the people in bad faith. And so we went into the bill and we tried to figure out where they're getting this from. Let me just read from the bill. It's not a large section of the bill. It certainly escaped us the first time. But under the hate crime section here, there is 17. The act is amended by adding the following: fear of hate propaganda offense or hate crime. A person may, with the Attorney General's consent, lay an information before a provincial court judge if the person fears, on reasonable grounds, that another person will commit hate speech. You can go to a judge and say that we have reason to believe that this person is going to commit hate speech. And then adjudication, if the judge is satisfied by the evidence that people have reasonable grounds for fear, the judge may order the defendant enter into a recognizance to keep the peace and be of good behavior for a period of not more than 12 months. And then if they refuse to enter into recognizance, the judge may commit the defendant to prison for a term of not more than 12 months. I don't know that these terrifying stories are extrapolating that far from what's actually in the bill. And I'm trying to get my head around, what the hell is this in here for? Like, what is the circumstance under which this would occur?
Okay, three things. First of all, I don't know what the circumstances is that the lawyers have in mind in putting that into the bill. That's the first thing. Secondly, I want to be clear. I'm not a fan of restrictions on speech, okay? And I'm not an advocate for the bill. But what we primarily talk about here is the media, in shortcut.
You got it.
Right. And what I'm also not a fan of is the media failing to do justice to complexity, which we do, you and I and all our colleagues do again and again and again, because of all the rituals and, you know, kind of exigencies that are in the business. We continually fail to do justice to complexity. So, for example, you know, what you read accurately. But what was it that you were reading? It wasn't actually about criminal behavior being punished. It was about people having a right to go to court to ask for protection against something they fear, which is very old law. If you think your ex-partner, you know, has armed themselves with a gun and you have a reasonable reason to fear that they intend using it on you, you have a right to go to court and say, I want them kept away from my street. And if the court thinks that's reasonable, that's what a recognizance is. This is an order saying, keep away from her street, or sometimes even just don't go near her or don't attack her, just leave her alone.
We have peace bonds, which in the States are known as restraining orders. And usually it's, you know, how do you determine reasonable grounds if you're going to limit somebody's freedom? It's because they have made threats or they have been violent in the past. As aberrant as it sounds to have like future crimes, you know, like if you have reasonable fear that a crime is going to be committed, then the court can step in preventatively. If you're going to accept that hate speech is a crime that harms people, then I guess the same rules apply. You know, whether it's right or wrong, no one's making that up. So the minister responsible, Arif Virani, has answered this criticism and tried to explain himself. And here's what he is quoted as saying in the Globe and Mail. He said that this new power could prove very, very important to restrain the behavior of somebody with a track record of hateful behavior who may be targeting certain people or groups. Here's the quote. If there's a genuine fear of an escalation, then an individual or group could come forward and seek a peace bond against them to prevent them from doing certain things. So that might mean not allowing the person to be close to a synagogue or a mosque. It could lead to restrictions on internet use and behavior. That would help to de-radicalize people, again a quote, who are learning things online and acting out in the real world violently, sometimes fatally. I don't know if this nuance calms down the conversation for me or actually makes me more concerned. This is imagining a regime in which not only can you go to prison for life for things you've said, but you could lose really fundamental civil liberties for things you might say based on things that you have said.
I'm also not a fan of criminalizing speech, okay? I'm a senior fellow at the Center for Free Expression, which tells you something.
Yeah, come on.
But again, because the discourse has been so wildly kind of wrong and decontextualized, I think let's get the discourse back onto the actual wording of the bill.
Mm-hmm.
So life imprisonment for hate speech you're talking about. Well, life imprisonment actually for advocating or promoting genocide.
Mm-hmm.
Let's be clear. Is that a good thing? Bad thing? Probably bad thing, in my opinion. But nevertheless, it's not just for anything you say that somebody can take offense at. Secondly, what is hate speech anyway? Jesse, have you ever received or seen or been asked to sign a legal contract with the words "for greater certainty" in it?
I cannot answer that with any great certainty because that would require me to actually read the contracts that I sign.
Well, for the record, Jesse, a lot of contracts do have these words because in the lawyer's opinion, one lawyer or another's opinion, something could be a little bit ambiguous. These words matter. And the rhetoric about this hate speech stuff has been such that it focuses on all of the things that could be misinterpreted by some judge or some prosecutor or somebody threatening somebody in the future, and ignores something which is worth taking a look at, which is the actual definitions in the laws. And I say laws because it amends several laws or creates new laws, and particularly the clauses that say for greater certainty. And one such clause says for greater certainty, and this is about content that foments hatred, the kind of content that the law has in mind for greater certainty is not content that is problematic, and this is a quote, solely because it expresses disdain or dislike or because it discredits, humiliates, hurts, or offends. That's worth noting.
It is, and I think that I am familiar with this distinction, and it's one that isn't widely understood because hate is just such a part of English language. It's like little children, I hate it, get it away from, you know, we think we know what hate means, but hate under the law is very narrowly defined and rarely actually does speech meet the standard of hate that the law defines it as. However, because it's so widely misunderstood, it does have an impact on civil discourse, and people talk about the chill effect. So I don't really think there are some modifications in the Online Harms Bill to how we define hate and the penalties thereof. And some people are worried that this is actually going to, like, you know, greatly expand the definition and we're actually going to get our prisons filled with people for their tweets. I don't think that's going to happen. I haven't seen evidence to back that up. But I do think that when you introduce accurately into the public discourse the fact that we have hate speech laws in Canada, they carry maximum sentences of life in prison, and they include possible jail time for things that you might say, that is going to have an impact of some kind on the free press, free expression. It is going to affect how we communicate with each other. I don't know. I'm not a legal expert either, but I think a law that doesn't actually do what it's supposed to do but does a bunch of other things that it's not supposed to do is probably a bad law.
Well, I'm not a lawyer either, but I do know that laws do frequently contain clauses that don't have much to do with their main sort of published name. And there's a reason for that. There's a limited number of laws that people want to put through Parliament. So, for example, in this law, I don't know if you, when you were scanning through it, there's a whole bunch of stuff about bodily fluids. Did you notice that? There's pages and pages and pages of stuff about bodily fluids.
What?
Yeah. I don't know.
Where do bodily fluids and online harms intersect?
Well, it's something.
Don't answer that question, anyone.
My point being, there's a bunch of stuff in this bill that has nothing to do with the title of it. But in the real world, that's true a lot of the time in legislation. And people who are alarmed about it maybe should just chill. But talking of chill, because you talked about the chilling effect of this, I'm going to push back a little. As much as I don't want the government to regulate speech, and nor does our society, nor does our constitution, that argument about chilling of speech can be overstated. I mean, we do want, don't we, to live in a society where people actually do hesitate before they speak certain thoughts. People might be moved by their fear or by their prejudice or by their background to say something that, on reflection, they'd rather not say, or we'd rather they didn't say. It's not entirely a bad thing if laws and cultural influences actually make us think before we speak.
Ivor, this episode is brought to everybody by Indochino. I understand that you have recently gone on a trip. You were in Southeast Asia where they tailor bespoke clothing at very affordable prices and with an incredible level of craftsmanship. That's where I first had a suit that was actually made to measure. Did you do any clothes shopping while you were overseas?
Sadly, that's not one of my priorities.
Well, I got news for you. You don't have to travel to Vietnam or to Hong Kong. You can just shop with Indochino. Quality, convenience, and bespoke clothing. This is not something that is for the ultra wealthy or just to do when you're traveling. You can get custom clothing to order from the comfort of your home. The process is simple and convenient. I have tried it myself. It takes like 10 minutes. You take a few measurements. They have videos that walk you through it. You pick the fabrics and the accoutrements and little things. There's lots of options and little flair that you could put on it. I went with a charcoal flannel fabric. High quality. Feels fantastic. And then the clothing actually fits my very strange body. I can't get this with Off the Rack. Off the Rack does not suit my body. But when I am wearing Indochino, my fit is always on point.
I was going to say something about your strange body, but
you wouldn't be the first. Okay. Go bespoke without the boutique. Make quality convenient with Indochino. Go to Indochino.com. Use the code CanadaLand to get 10% off of any purchase of $399 or more. That's 10% off at Indochino.com with the code CanadaLand. This episode is brought to everybody by Douglas. Ivor, how do you sleep at night?
Really? Not well.
Well, that's because you know what you've done. Listen, your guilty conscience is going to be a problem no matter what, but your sleep, when you do finally lull yourself into sleep, is going to be a lot better on a Douglas mattress. I've tried this mattress. I apologize. I've tried this mattress, and it's an excellent mattress at a very affordable price point. Upgrading to a Douglas is easy as ABC. First, you order online. It is then shipped to your door in a handy box, and you'll be very surprised that they got the mattress into this box. When you open it, foomp, you've got this beautiful Douglas mattress. Very comfortable, medium firm support, a layer of cooling gel built right in. There's even a mattress cover included in the deal, which I don't know why anybody ever sells a mattress without a cover. Find out why for over 200,000 Canadians. Douglas equals a good night's sleep. Douglas is giving our listeners a free sleep bundle with each mattress purchase. Get the sheets, pillows, mattress, and pillow protectors free with your Douglas purchase today. Visit douglas.ca/CanadaLand to claim this offer. That is douglas.ca/CanadaLand. Ivor Shapiro, you are a longtime listener, first-time guest on Shortcuts, so you know that one of the sacred duties of appearing on the show is informing our listeners of news items that they may have otherwise missed, but which need to be duly noted. What have you?
This happened this week, Jesse. A Jew and a Palestinian talked on a Zoom webinar about Gaza, Hamas, the Holocaust, Zionism, power, fear, anger, hatred, violence, resistance, terrorism, racism, how people can learn to listen deeply to people who fear the opposite of what they themselves fear, all this stuff. These two men talked and the world didn't end. The two people are Raja Khoury and Jeffrey Wilkinson. They're co-authors of The Wall Between, What Jews and Palestinians Don't Want to Know About Each Other, a book that was published last year. And their recorded conversation, which was, I am proud to say, hosted by the Center for Free Expression, will be archived on our website probably around now. And I learned a lot from it. And I'd be willing to bet most other people will too.
Where can people find this?
At the Center for Free Expression's website, that's cfe.torontomu.ca.
Duly noted. I want to duly note the latest bit of progress in a story that we talked about recently, and that is that this spy has been located. This is a story people will remember about the scientist in the Level 4 lab in Winnipeg who turned out to have all kinds of secret activity with the Chinese government, and they were fired, Dr. Chu most notably. When last we spoke about this, there was a bunch of new revelations about just how in-depth their espionage and collaboration with China was while they were working at this lab. And a question that we were unable to answer, like there were signs pointing to, like, well, where has she gone? Why was she never charged or arrested with anything in Canada? And where in the world is Dr. Chu? And there was reason to speculate that she was in China. And that has turned out to be the case. Fife and Chase of the Globe and Mail have reported that she's been located working in China, collaborating with researchers from the People's Liberation Army. This is a hell of a story. I can't wait until all of it is put together and we get the whole thing. But for some reason, some of her most interesting stories seem to just, like, slip through the cracks here in Canada.
Duly noted.
Ivor, I understand you have one more for us.
I do. Maybe almost as surprising as the first, Jesse, Donald Trump was misquoted, or at least quoted out of context, and somebody cared. A colleague sent me a Substack column by a writer named Sam Cohn. He sent me this because my colleague knows I've been writing, thinking lately about whether journalists might actually agree on at least some minimal standards for news reporting. So Sam Cohn, you can tell from reading the column, clearly far from a sympathizer with Donald Trump, but he followed up the coverage of a recent speech, and I bet you and a lot of our listeners heard about it, which got a lot of press. And then what he did, Sam Cohn did, was he actually muscled up to actually gasp, listen to the speech. And clearly he found it a pretty disturbing and unpleasant way of spending his time, listening to a speech, a whole speech by Donald Trump. And you'd want to read Cohn's piece for the details. But bottom line, he found a few places where Trump was widely misquoted or quoted seriously out of context. I guess people can be forgiven for thinking that this particular man deserves no better. But, and I wouldn't argue with that, but what made me think was the column's final two sentences, which speak to the deeper value of journalists actually taking truthfulness seriously. And I just thought these two sentences might be worth noting. So here they are. If Trump is to be defeated and Trumpism overcome, the mainstream will have to maintain its realism and its dignity. And the adults in the room will need to avoid being sucked into loose play with the facts. What Trump actually is, what he actually stands for, is bad enough.
I have seen this in a lot of coverage. I've seen this in newsrooms, that there is a sliding scale whereby our responsibility to portray somebody fairly, to quote them accurately, to seek comment, is contingent on what we think of them and how they interact with the truth. And when a source or subject of coverage is just mendacious and can't be trusted and does not have credibility, journalists start to excuse themselves for not practicing our craft at the standard that it should be upheld. I think that there are nuances in this because you do have to deal with, you know, when people respond or they deny something, whether or not they have credibility does matter, you know. And there are times when you say, well, I'm not going to publish this full, this is so obviously untrue that I'm not just going to give equal time and here's when they denied it, because it's, you know, you can't tell me that it's raining out when I can put out my hand and see that, you know, like, that's still practicing journalism.
Or that human-made climate change isn't a thing.
Yeah, that's not fairness, just giving somebody, you know, your credibility does matter and your relationship to the truth and how you've dealt with the press in the past does matter, and it is going to factor into journalistic decisions. But I have seen reporters say, like, you know, I'm not going to ask that person because they're just going to lie to me. Well, you know, like, because they have abandon any kind of ethics does not mean that we have permission to do the same. Duly noted. This episode, Ivor, is brought to everybody by Rotman Executive Programs. Do you get nostalgic for the early days of artificial intelligence, Ivor, when it was, you know, AI was just curating our news feeds, doing its thing?
No, it keeps me up at night.
Oh, those good old days. AI is now actually generating the content, not just curating the news feeds. It's like a big deal. It is affecting everything. My feeling is that we don't, and having been a tech journalist, is that it is going to have a huge impact, but it'll be different than the impact we think it's going to be. Organizations have not made the leap to AI yet, But that is going to change pretty quickly. If you are finding the prospect of generative AI confusing or a bit unnerving, you're not alone. Probably your boss or management at your company is wondering the same thing and they want to get on top of it. And this is why Rotman put together the Generative AI and Organizational Transformation Program. Talking about a three-day program designed to get you up to speed on AI and give you everything you need to create a strategic roadmap for integrating this ever-evolving technology into your organization. 3 days of training and learning, and then you become an expert within your organization. It looks great on your CV. Don't get left behind. Visit www.uoft.me/RotmanAI to learn more. One more time here. Don't forget the W's. www.uoft.me/RotmanAI. Check it out.
2023 was a record-setting year for immigration.
Statistics Canada says the number of non-permanent residents grew by more than 500,000 people in 2023.
It's an historic surge driven by international students and temporary workers.
There are some people talking about whether the pace of immigration should be slowed down, largely because of the pressure on infrastructure, housing in particular.
Canada's immigration minister says the massive influx has stretched an already strained housing market.
To ensure that there is no further growth in the number of international students in Canada for 2024, we are setting a national application intake cap for a period of 2 years.
According to documents obtained by the Canadian press, bureaucrats warned the government 2 years ago a spike in migration would drive up home prices. The Liberal government pushed ahead with its ambitious plan.
We need to make a link between the number of homes built and the number of people we invite as new Canadians.
Ivor, immigration is everywhere right now. And I guess the one stat that popped out at me the most, Stats Can't Put This Out, Daily Hive reported on this, under a year, it's just been months since Canada hit the 40 million mark in terms of population, and we're about to hit 41 million. So that's like, oh, that's a lot really quick. That's a lot really quick. A lot of people. And, you know, the Canadian population, we don't replace ourselves. So it's got to come from somewhere. It's immigration. And this is one of those issues that, like, I think everybody gets a little bit tense when it gets brought up because it plays into traditional left-right divides. But I don't know that that's what I'm seeing here, looking at what's in the press, because the reality of immigration and the nuance of dealing with that reality is sort of right in front of everybody's eyes. So linking immigration to the housing shortage may be missing the problem, experts say. This is a CBC piece, you know, really examining some nuance in this relationship between immigration and housing. Here is a National Post headline: life in Canada is more expensive than most immigrants expected, new poll finds. That is not consistent, sort of like from the perspective of the new immigrant, you know, finding problems with life in Canada, not necessarily the perspective you'd expect from the National Post. Why the argument that immigration is the sole cause of soaring home prices is flawed. This is in the Financial Post. And then if you would expect conservative rhetoric to be sort of anti-immigrant, and we've seen that in the past, and we've seen various conservative leaders talking about how we don't want people from this country because they're going to bring in bad values. That's not really what we're hearing right now. We're hearing more of a policy-based complaint from Polyev and proposed policy solutions that this has just been mismanaged and we're going to continue with immigration. This plan of his that we've discussed recently to tie immigration levels to home building so that there's a relationship between the amount of housing that we have and the amount of people that we bring in, where we do get that traditional resistance to newcomers because they're going to dilute our culture. Well, Quebec, but, you know, Quebec asks Ottawa for full power over immigration. Trudeau says no. I can't really find fault with, like, there's a flurry of stories that I think are really looking at everything from, should we be continuing to fill our schools with international students, and what problems is that creating, not only on housing, but for the students themselves? We saw stories earlier out of the Atlantic provinces of some of these, like, small college towns where, like, it was just a terrible situation where the streets were filled with homeless kids from overseas, not used to our temperatures, and, like, grandparents in New Brunswick, like, saying, like, just come in and sleep in the basement because, like, you know, somebody died in a small New Brunswick town from exposure on the streets. Like, I think we are getting away from rhetoric in our conversation about this, getting away from ideology and dealing with reality. And this is what I've been playing with in my head, Ivor, is that you could look at, like, the whole Justin Trudeau era of leadership in Canada as a reckoning between the happy myths that Canada likes to tell itself and the reality of the application of those myths. And so when we look at Trudeau at his apex in the early moments, embracing this kind of Doug Saunders, maximum Canada, like, and this is an ethic of Canada that I'm really bought into. I'm not a super patriotic guy, but the idea that we welcome people here who need a place to be, greeting the Syrian refugees at the airport, like as many as we can take in, let's take them in. I get emotional about those. I believe in that vision of Canada. And then you fast forward to this point, which I think is probably the end of the Trudeau years. And we're seeing that if you do not match that ambition and that ideology with good policy, you can create a number of knock-on effects that can be bad for everything from housing prices to homelessness, bad for the people coming here, bad for us. It's not super interesting to have a segment about how the media is doing a good job with something, but I have to give credit where it's due. It seems like this topic is spiking in the amount of coverage it's getting and in like interesting and thoughtful ways.
Right, but you haven't seen tomorrow's edition of the Toronto Star, have you?
Have you?
No.
If you've seen tomorrow's edition of the Toronto Star, we got to have you on the show more often.
Point being, what you just said sounds really positive, and I echo a brief respite from rhetoric that isn't rooted in actual consideration of actual facts. It may just be that it's too soon to tell, but I hope that might be a whole new trend for media in this country, that we're going to stop tamping down on ill-considered, overstated, exaggerated stuff about government doing the job that we actually elect governments to do, which is manage the economy. It's one of the prime duties of the government. Housing is part of the economy. Immigration targets are part of the economy. Nobody on any side of the political spectrum, as far as I know, is talking about stopping immigration or accelerating immigration by 100%. People are talking about what should drive the policy decision year to year of how many permanent residents we are targeting for Canada in the coming year.
Mm-hmm.
It's an economic number. And the idea of matching that number with the rest of one's economic policy, including where we're going to put him, sounds like a good idea. It is literally the first time in about, oh God, perhaps ever, that I've heard this leader of the opposition say something that sounds actually quite sensible.
Yeah, I mean, the overall housing policies put forth by Poilievre do not withstand a whole lot of scrutiny. But if you look at his immigration policy, he is running on a platform which is sort of like a return to just reasonable thinking.
Wouldn't it be nice to believe him?
Right now, I don't mind the tenor of the conversation. There are some things in the media that stick out like a sore thumb. And I think this was actually probably just like a little error. But I like to live in a Canada where these things are ugly anomalies. I'm talking here about a weird CBC story. Here's the headline. International student charged after alleged voyeurism involving cell phone at U of T residence. A friend of mine pointed this out to me, like, why are they identifying him as an international student?
That is weird.
You know, like we stopped for a long time ago, you know, like black Torontonian arrested on, like we stopped doing these identifiers. So why, like, it's a very strange thing. And we tracked it back and it's like, okay, the CBC are actually, they got that information from the cops. The cops said, This guy, Peeping Tom, at a U of T residence is an international student.
Okay, but headline writing is not the same function as reporting.
That's right. Well, first, like, our best guess at the cops is that there's a very strict formula for when they put out these releases about who they arrested. And usually that's the part where they say, Thornhill resident arrested. And my guess is because he's an international student, some cop looking at a blank field on the press release form is like, well, we don't know where he lives, so I can't say, you know, U of T resident. So we'll say international student. And maybe it's the responsibility of the CBC headliner to be like, you know what? Leading with the word international student in an environment where international students are under so much scrutiny right now, and they could easily become the ones who are blamed for situations that they were, you know, we've done a lot of coverage of how they're enticed to come here, promised that it's a path to residency, dumped in like the, you know, suburban campus of some affiliated college where there's just not even proper services. And in some cases, like in Cape Breton, you know, housing shortage, like, you know, they're not the bad guys in this story. I don't think the CBC intended to make them the bad guys, but this is a headline in which international student is the bad guy.
Right. You know, since we're talking shit about the media, one of the things that I think is worth talking shit about is headline writing. The standard of headline writing in the media has fallen because there are far fewer people employed to think about writing headlines. I was recently asked by someone who works for a publication in Canada about, you know, the publication's use of the headlines that are written by wire services on their stories. And somebody said, well, you know, we just don't have the resources to edit wire copy anymore. And, you know, times are tough. Get with it. Let the wire service write the headline. And I'm like, you know, if you don't have the resources to think about the headline writing in a day and age when the headline is usually the only thing people see on their news feeds, you probably don't have the resources to be in the news business at all.
It's a tremendous abdication of the basic responsibility. Like, you're actually saying we cannot be held responsible for what we publish. Right? Like, you know, and it's become just such industry practice. Like, yeah, like a lot of what we publish is fed to us by wire services, just like everybody else. What do you expect us to do? Times are tough. It's like, I couldn't make that case here. If people are like, what was that audacious thing you published? Like, I didn't listen to it.
Yeah.
I just publish it.
Who has the resources to listen to what we publish? It takes us right back to Elon Musk saying, you know, you're advocating censorship because you want us to edit what goes on our platform. Well, you know, we do edit what goes on our platform. At Elon, you do. Of course you edit. You're a publisher.
And the algorithm is itself a form of an editor.
Absolutely. And who writes the algorithm? People employed by you.
Ivor Shapiro, that is Shortcuts for this week. Thank you for joining me.
You're so welcome. It was a pleasure to be with you.
I can be emailed about anything you heard today at jesse@canadaland.com. I read everything you send. And our website is canadaland.com. Ivor, where can people find you and remind people what your book is called?
My book is called The Disputed Freedoms of a Disrupted Press. It's available from all the usual places people get books and ebooks. And where can people find me? At cfe.torontomu.ca.
This episode is produced by James Nicholson with additional production by Caleb Thompson. Our production coordinator is Andre Proulx. Our editor-in-chief is Karen Pugliese. Our theme music is by So-Called, syndications by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. You can visit them online at cfuv.ca. If you value this podcast, if you like listening to us talk about the news, if we help keep you informed, if you like what my colleagues do on our other shows, all of this stuff that we provide to you for free, what I'm asking you to do this month is rate us, review us on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. That really does help other people find Canada Land. Or think of one person in your life who might not know that we're here and tell them. That is how you grow a podcast audience, and that would be an enormous help to us. If you want to support us directly, which is how we keep the lights on, go to canadaland.com/join. There's a bunch of great stuff we give you when you become a supporter of Canada Land. Click on the link in the show notes, or once again, go to canadaland.com/join. You can listen ad-free on Amazon Music, included with Prime.